to today's reading of Sports Today, a one-hour reading of sports news from 7 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday and Thursday. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Some Sounds of Arizona. And let's begin today's reading with a feature that's entitled, Trainer Bill Mott's Second Kentucky Derby Win is Sweeter Than the First. And this feature, written by Dan Wolken, columnist for USA Today, Dateline, Louisville, Kentucky. He was 14 years old, sitting in the front seat of his GMC pickup truck, listening to the radio call of Bobby Ussery ride Proud Clarion to a 30-1 upset in the Kentucky Derby. It would be a nice, tidy story if Bill Mott could tell people now that when he started training horses, he would eventually do it for men who build airplanes and rule countries, and that he would get some who could bring him into the winner's circle of the biggest race in the world. But that wouldn't be true, because from his tiny town in South Dakota, across the Missouri River from the state capitol pier, even bringing a horse to Churchill Downs, much less running in the Kentucky Derby, could have felt too big. I never even imagined that I would ever be here, he said. It was just a dream that was too far away. And to be up here thinking back at that, it's like going to outer space, unquote. But to blast off into the atmosphere, you need a rocket ship. And on May the 3rd, Sovereignty turned on the afterburners in a stretch of the 151st Kentucky Derby, passing race favorite Journalism and bending Mott's time-space continuum in more than one way. Because even though it wasn't the first Kentucky Derby win for a trainer who's been among the best in the sport for four decades, it almost felt like it. In 2019, the Mott trainee Country House was named the Derby winner when the Kentucky Racing Stewards disqualified Maximum Security for drifting out at the top of the stretch and interfering with two other horses. Mott was, of course, happy to finally be a Derby winner. They lifted the trophy, got the garland of roses, and celebrated into the night. But it was admittedly awkward, if not downright bittersweet, to get there that way. This, watching Sovereignty settle into 16th early in the race, circle the field on the outside, coming around the second turn, and then outduel Journalism in the stretch, it is much, much better. You have the joy of being here, said Riley Mott, his 33-year-old son, who is now a trainer with his own string of 40 horses. But crossing the wire first is a different animal, unquote. So is Sovereignty, and so is Mott. In a sport where the characters on the backstretch are famously good at overhype, misdirection, and sometimes a little bit of chicanery, Mott is one trainer that you'll never hear a bad word about. For more than 30 years in the national spotlight, beginning when he trained the great Cigar to a remarkable 16-race winning streak in 1995 and 1996, Mott has been regarded as a consummate gentleman and a patient, old-school horseman who never pushes them beyond their capabilities. Mott hadn't run many horses in the Derby, just 8 prior to Country House, relative to the success that he had in other big races. He might have been a little too patient, knowing just how little time you have to develop a horse to get them ready to run 1.25 miles on the first Saturday in May of their 3-year-old year. He wasn't going to enter a horse just to be at the party. Quote, to win these types of races, you can't have many hiccups in your training schedule or the way the horse is doing, Mott said. To underline that point, consider that Sovereignty is the first Kentucky Derby winner for Godolphin, the international racing and breeding operation owned by Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, the head of the ruling family of Dubai. The Maktoums have almost certainly spent more money on horses than any human beings in the history of the world, and they have won pretty much every race around the world worth winning, from the Epsom Derby in England to the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe in France to the Japan Cup to the Melbourne Cup to the Breeders' Cup Classic. But none of them had ever won the Kentucky Derby until this year, and it certainly wasn't for lack of trying. That's horse racing, though. Everything has to go right, not just on race day, but for months leading up to the race. That's why the little guys, relatively speaking, always have a chance on Derby Day. But this year, the biggest fish in the sport just happened to swallow them all. It's been a long time coming, said Michael Banahan, the director of American Bloodstock for Godolphin. Do we expect to win these types of races? No, you don't. You just expect to have some nice horses that you can give them the opportunity and give them great trainers like we have. And if we get one good enough to win the Derby, fantastic. We certainly don't think that just because we have some nice horses that we're going to be able to get a seat at this table and be the winner of the race, unquote. But there were some clues that maybe Sovereignty was different. Despite starting his career 0-for-2 at shorter distances last summer, it said a lot about what kind of talent Mott thought that he had in his barn when he entered Sovereignty in the Street Sense, an important 2-year-old stakes race at Churchill Downs last October. Sovereignty won that race easily, coming from last place, showing that he enjoyed the Churchill Downs surface and that he could thrive in longer races. Suddenly, the Derby was the obvious goal. But for the next 4 months, Sovereignty disappeared to the anonymity of Payson Park, a training center in Florida. He did not surface again until March the 1st at the Fountain of Youth Stakes, when he once again made a sweeping wide move to win by a neck and establish himself as a legitimate contender. But it was such a big effort coming off a long layoff that Mott did not push the colt too hard to get ready for the Florida Derby 4 weeks later, knowing that the more important goal was still ahead. Still, Sovereignty finished a good second to Tappan Street, who had to scratch from the Kentucky Derby due to an injury. Mott still felt as if his horse was on track and improving. But the betting public wasn't as enamored with that effort as Mott was and allowed Sovereignty to go off at 7-1 by post time. And as jockey Junior Alvarado guided Sovereignty from the number 18 post to a ground-saving position on the rail around the first turn, Mott felt good, especially when he saw fast early fractions on the front end that would favor horses coming from behind. But still, even though he would always be a Derby winner, he didn't quite know what it would feel like to watch his horse cross the finish line first. Quote, "They are all special, and I don't want to take anything away from Country House's effort because he actually ran a very good race on that day," Mott said. "The stewards did the right thing. It was a no-brainer that they put us up. But this is better," unquote. And again, that feature entitled Trainer Bill Mott's Second Derby Win is Sweeter Than the First, written by Dan Wolken, columnist for USA Today. And in another horse racing feature, this one's entitled Triple Crown Needs New Winning Formula. This feature also written by Dan Wolken, columnist for USA Today. Dateline, Louisville, Kentucky. Every Kentucky Derby winning trainer has the same day-after script when it comes to bringing their horse to the Preakness Stakes, and the line is usually some non-committal variation of, quote-unquote, they'll tell us if they're physically ready to run back just 2 weeks later in the second jewel of the Triple Crown. Bill Mott was no different on May the 4th, the morning after Sovereignty's victory on the Kentucky Derby. But you could almost see the thought bubble forming around his words, telling the world not to be too surprised if he and the management team at Godolphin, which owns the horse, decide to take a pass on Baltimore. It's good to have that option, Mott told reporters waiting at his barn. I don't think that we're dead set on it. I don't think that that's the only thing that we're thinking about, unquote. Uh-oh. Is anyone in horse racing going to listen when the best trainers in the world and the people responsible for the health and well-being of the animal tell you over and over again that the Triple Crown is no longer viable in its current format? Sorry, traditionalists, but it is time for the Triple Crown to change. It doesn't have to be anything radical, but the modern racehorse is not bred or built to run three long races in 5 weeks, and there isn't a single high-level trainer in the country who would put their horse through that gauntlet unless there was an historic achievement on the line. Those who have resisted adding some time between the races have long argued that it cheapens the achievement if you remove part of the challenge. But what's actually been happening over the past several years is that so few horses run in all three races, it's already being cheapened. The ones that do, in general, don't come out better for it on the other side. Last year, Derby winner Mystic Dan ran in all three legs and then disappeared until December. He is 0-3 since then. And Mage, the 2023 winner of the Kentucky Derby, ran in the Preakness and was never the same, retiring after two more races and several physical issues. I think over the years, people realize that spacing these horses out a little bit gives you the opportunity to make them last a little longer, Mott said. I think that we're looking at a career, you know, and you want the career to last more than 5 weeks, unquote. There could not be a more damning indictment of how the Triple Crown is now perceived. This isn't the 1940s when it was common for thoroughbreds to run every couple of weeks and sometimes actually run races in between the three-week gap separating the Preakness and Belmont. This isn't the 1980s when one of the premier Derby preps, the Bluegrass Stakes, was actually held 9 days before the run for the Roses. It's not even 2015 when American Pharoah broke the 37-year drought and proved to the racing world that it could still be done. And even as modern thoroughbreds become more injury-prone and less sturdy due to inbreeding and the commercial appeal of speed pedigrees over stamina, it can still be done. But at what cost? It's a long season, and he's had three hard races since February, and that takes a lot out of those horses, Michael Banahan, the director of American Bloodstock for Godolphin, told reporters. Quote, it's a quick turnaround, and that's what makes the Triple Crown so special. He'll tell us yay or nay, and we'll do what he tells us to do. There's lots of great opportunities and really good races to try to compete in and see if we can pad his resume even more, unquote. That last part seems significant. Because for the connections of a horse like Sovereignty, the Kentucky Derby was the goal, full stop. Everything they did in the winter and spring was designed to have him at his peak of fitness on the first Saturday in May to run an incredibly grueling race. Often, the horses are so fit after the Derby that they can bounce right back 2 weeks later and deliver another monster performance. But it does grind them up, and the Preakness, for all of its tradition and fanfare, is really just another big race. Yeah, running for a $2 million purse is nice, but what if the result is that they end up with a tired horse that isn't going to run in the $1 million Haskell Stakes or the $1.25 million Travers at Saratoga or the $7 million Breeders' Cup Classic at the end of the season? Quote, "I think the Triple Crown is a huge challenge for any horse," Mott said. "The great thing about it is not many horses are able to do it, and certainly I believe that he's a big, strong horse, and if you're ever going to look at one, and if that's your goal and the goal of the owner, and still in the best interest of the horse, it's great. Everybody knows that American Pharoah won it, and Justify won it in 2018, but we're going to look long-term," unquote. If horse racing had its act together, this wouldn't be a debate. There would be 3 weeks or a month between the Derby and Preakness, then another month to get ready for the Belmont. It would still be extremely hard to win, maybe harder because the Preakness and Belmont would have better fields. And it wouldn't be the end of the world, though the spacing of the Triple Crown races has been consistent for decades. It has moved around a bit since the early days. There is nothing sacrosanct about squeezing it into 5 weeks. And the powers that be should have started a real conversation about changing things when they noticed in the 2010s how few horses anymore were running in all three races. After that thrilling Kentucky Derby, what could possibly be better for horse racing than having a Preakness where you get Sovereignty, Journalism, and Beza back for a rematch on a different track with different conditions? Instead, Pimlico will be lucky if one of those three horses shows up. And if that's the case, what's even the point of the Preakness anymore? As much as most fans want to see Sovereignty try for the Triple Crown, trainer Bill Mott holding him out of the race might just be the moment of clarity that horse racing needs to finally admit that the current format is no longer in the best interests of the sport. And again, that feature, entitled Triple Crown Needs a New Winning Formula, written by Dan Wolken, columnist for USA Today. And from horse racing news, let's turn now to some baseball news. The headline for the next feature reads, "Oldest Living New York Met Looks Back at 70 Years in Baseball." And this feature, written by Bob Nightingale of USA Today, Dateline, Scottsdale, Arizona. John Wooden recruited him to play basketball at UCLA, while Branch Rickey wanted him to play baseball for the Brooklyn Dodgers. He was teammates with Hall of Famers Willie Mays, Roberto Clemente, Willie McCovey, Ernie Banks, and Larry Doby during his playing career. He managed Hall of Famers Billy Williams and Bruce Sutter. He worked for Charlie Finley, and he hung out with Sadaharu Oh. Welcome to the beautiful life of Jim Marshall. Jim Marshall is an original member of the infamous 1962 New York Mets, and was honored on May the 5th as the oldest living Met before their night game against the Arizona Diamondbacks at Chase Field. Quote, "I worked in baseball for 70 years," said Marshall, who turns 94 years old later this month. "And as a baseball player or manager, We always dream of being number one. Well, I finally made it," unquote. His greatest memory of that season, when the New York Mets went 40 wins, 120 losses, and produced the most losses until the Chicago White Sox toppled it last year. Quote, "Opening day at the Polo Grounds," Marshall says. "They were doing the player introductions, and when they got to me, they booed the hell out of me because Gil Hodges wasn't playing. He was hurt, but they just buried me. Welcome to New York," unquote. Rufus James Marshall, who has gone by his middle name since attending Compton High School in California, spent 5 years in the major leagues as a first baseman and pinch hitter. He played 3 years in Japan for the Chunichi Dragons. He managed the Chicago Cubs for 3 years and Oakland Athletics for 1 year. He scouted nearly 25 years for the Arizona Diamondbacks. He spent 2 hours with USA Today Sports talking about his life, his fondest memories, and favorite funny moments from his 70-year pro baseball career. One of his memories is Casey Stengel's trouble with names. Quote, "Casey was so bad with names, and when I was playing for the Mets, he kept calling me Blanchard. There was a Johnny Blanchard with the Yankees where he had managed before. He kept calling me Blanchard, so I just let him do it. One day, I'm in the batter's box at the Polo Grounds, and here comes Casey out of the dugout. I step out, and he says to me, 'Shoot for the lines, shoot for the lines.' I say, 'What the hell does that mean?' And he says, 'All of the players are in the middle of the field, so shoot for the lines.' I guess it made sense. He didn't know the players' names, but I'll tell you one thing, he was magic with the press," unquote. Next, we look at the time that he saw his life flash before his eyes. Quote, "I'm facing Bob Gibson. The batter ahead of me dug a pretty good hole in the batter's box, so I'm just filling in the hole, brushing dirt into it. Gibson sees me and says, 'Make it nice and comfortable, because that's where you're going to be laying,' unquote. And I thought, 'Holy smokes, I think he means it.' And sure enough, he knocked me down on my butt. He went right at my head. That ball just missed me. If it hit me, I wouldn't be sitting here today," unquote. And Jim Marshall next reflects on the Ichiro family fandom. Quote, "When I was scouting the Pacific Rim, I saw Ichiro Suzuki a lot, and he told me that his dad was a huge Chunichi Dragons fan and actually has a picture of me in their house. Ichiro was such a great guy, great kid. He would always call me Gaijin, which means foreigner in Japanese. So the first time I see him when he gets to Seattle, I walk into their clubhouse and say, 'Well, you're the Gaijin now.' And he says, 'Oh, grandfather, don't tease me.' I remember how he wanted to come to America so bad, and he used to come and swing the bat right in front of me, and then we'd go have dinner together. He was my favorite player, my absolute favorite player. The dedication, the discipline, the speed, the arm. My God, he had it all. I knew Ichiro would be a great player, but not a Hall of Famer. He could run, he could play defense, and he could spray the ball. The crazy thing is, he could have been a great home run hitter if he wanted to, but chose to be a batting champion. That's how talented he was," unquote. In 1963, Marshall was the first American-born player to go from the major leagues to Japan. Quote, "I was playing in Pittsburgh. The season is over. And Joe Brown, the general manager, calls me into his office. He says, 'You don't have a chance of making this team next year. We got two first basemen, If I were you, I'd go to Japan and make good money. I want you and your wife to fly over, see if you feel comfortable, and see if you want to do it. It changed my whole life. I love the people there. I made some good money and played every day. They had such a love for baseball, and nobody ever talked about the war. The only trouble was when we went to places like Osaka and Hiroshima, and the crowd chanted, "Go home, white monkey," in Japanese. But the players protected me, unquote. Marshall's favorite teammate was Piper Davis, his teammate with the Oakland Oaks in the Pacific Coast League. Quote, "I was in the Pacific Coast League, and Piper took me under his wing. We would go to each other's room and talk baseball almost every night, which was unusual back in the day. He would tell me so much about Willie Mays and how he helped develop him and protect him from outside influence. I love the man. What a special person." Unquote. Davis played for the Birmingham Black Barons and the Homestead Grays in the Negro Leagues, and later managed Birmingham. He was most famous for getting Willie Mays to play for the Black Barons in 1947 when Mays was just 16 years old. Mays credits him in his early development into becoming one of the greatest players in history. Davis nearly joined Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby, breaking the color barrier in 1947 when he was signed by the St. Louis Browns, but never got to play in the majors. That was such a shame because he was such a fabulous man, Marshall said. I would have loved to have seen that, unquote. Jim Marshall is next asked who his favorite player was to manage, and he replies, quote, "It's tough to separate, but I've got to say Rick Monday is on the top of the list when I manage the Cubs. He was such a great young kid. I was there the day that he grabbed the American flag when those kids were about to burn it. That was the greatest play of his career. I told Rick, 'You owe me money, man. I put you in the lineup so you could do that. Now you have a lifetime job with the Dodgers.' So now he gives me a dollar every time he sees me," unquote. And his favorite player to watch, quote, "Hank Aaron, oh my goodness. I couldn't believe that wrist action. Those are the days that you got knocked down quite a bit, I'm telling you. But he would get right back up and hit. He was quiet about it, too. I never saw him get emotional. He was one special player. I did remember outdoing him in something. I played in Memphis, and they had a sign for steamed laundry. If you hit that sign, you get $1,100. I was really proud of that. Some guy came up to me and said, 'Did you know that Hank Aaron and Eddie Matthews just missed it?' Well, I got it, and that was one of my biggest thrills in baseball," unquote. Jim Marshall was part of the first interleague trade in baseball history when the Cubs traded him along with pitcher Dave Hillman to the Boston Red Sox for first baseman Dick Genert on November 21, 1959. Quote, "I never played a game for them. They didn't want left-handed pull hitters. They wanted right-handed hitters. So they traded me in spring training to Cleveland. I go down there, put on my uniform, and I'm really happy. Then I was traded along with Sammy White, a great catcher, for Russ Nixon. Well, 9 days later, White decides to retire. Now the trade is over, and I've got to go back to the Red Sox, and I know that they don't want me. So the general manager comes over and tells me, 'Jim, my wife is swimming over in the apartment right beyond right field. Go spend the day with her, and by the end of the day, I'll find a team for you.' And at the end of the day, I went to the San Francisco Giants. You know something? I got a nice letter from him later on apologizing, That was so nice of him," unquote. Marshall was next asked about his favorite ballpark. Quote, "It had to be Wrigley Field, and that's when they still had people sitting in center field with white shirts. It was tough to see. But my very first game there as a Cub, in August of 1958, I hit 3 home runs in one day. I hit 2 in the first game of the doubleheader against the Phillies, and they were forced to put me into the second game, and I homered again. I couldn't believe it. Unfortunately, I only hit 2 more homers the rest of the season. I still remember sitting on the bench in Chicago. We're playing the Giants, and there's a young guy sitting next to me on the bench. They called on him to go pinch hit, and he struck out on 3 pitches. He came back and sat back down next to me, and I said, 'Don't worry, kid. Things are going to get better.' It was Billy Williams. So, yeah, things got a lot better for him. And then there was Ernie Banks, another great teammate. We had been beating this team pretty good, and, well, they somehow found out that we were stealing signs. The next day, they decided that Banks would be the target. They brushed back a few guys, but when they got to Banks, they hit him right in the middle of the back, down by his spine. He could hardly move the next day. He's not out there in the field for batting practice and could barely walk up the flight of stairs up to the clubhouse. I don't think he's even playing. Well, the game starts, he's in the lineup, and he hits a grand slam. He went around the bases without saying a word. Yes, sir, did I ever admire him," unquote. Marshall was next asked what the best gesture by a teammate was. Quote, "I went to the Chicago White Sox when Larry Doby, the first black player in American League history, was there. I walked into the clubhouse, and the first thing he said was, 'Jim, anything in my locker you could have. My bat, glove, take whatever you want, okay?' He couldn't have been nicer. We played catch a few times together. He was a great player and an awfully nice man," unquote. Marshall next reflected on the famous batting race. It was the final day of the 1976 season, and Cubs infielder Bill Madlock was trailing Ken Griffey Sr. in the batting race, hitting 338 to 333. While Griffey was kept out of the lineup to help preserve his batting title, Madlock promptly went 4-for-4, increasing his batting average to 339. Quote, "I got a call from upstairs, and they said to not let Madlock hit. Take him out now." And I said, "Man, he's 4-for-4. But they explained that he just went ahead of Griffey in the batting race. So I went to Madlock to tell him, and he asked why. I told him, 'Just do me a favor and walk to the clubhouse.' He went down there, and Sparky hurried Griffey back into the game, and he struck out twice and ended up short with a 336 average. I've got to say, it was the first time in my life that I took a guy out of a game who was going 4-for-4 for the day," unquote. Jim Marshall next reflects on his favorite Vin Scully memory. Quote, "I remember walking out of the stadium one day with Vin Scully, and Vinny says, 'I'm going to move.' And I say, 'Vinny, you've got a nice home. Why are you going to move?' And he said, 'My neighbor keeps throwing trash over my fence.' And I said, 'Well, why the hell don't you tell him?' And he says, 'Well, it's Sylvester Stallone. Come on, what can I do?'" Unquote. And Jim Marshall next reflects on his favorite Jackie Robinson tribute. Quote, "I got to become good friends with Don Newcomb, and he played a year for the Chunichi Dragons, too. So I said one day, 'Nuke, tell me about Jackie Robinson. I saw Jackie play football at UCLA.' Nuke goes, 'Well, I'll tell you something, Jim. he's not much fun to be with. He is such a fierce competitor that you can't have fun doing anything with him. He's out to beat your expletive in golf or whatever else you want to do. It wasn't a knock on Jackie. That's just the way he was, unquote. And finally, there's Jim Marshall's ring collection. Marshall was wearing his 2001 Diamondbacks World Series ring on his left hand and the 2023 National League pennant ring on his right hand at lunch, and he also has a Chunichi Dragons championship ring and a AAA Denver Bears championship ring at home, as well as a ring honoring him from the Professional Baseball Scouts Foundation. So, which one's his favorite? My wedding ring, he said. Bev was everything to me. I met her in junior high school at Roosevelt in Compton. We met because we were listening together to the 1946 World Series on the radio between the Red Sox and the Cardinals during class. She was from Missouri and was a Cardinals fan. We got married when I was 19 and were married for 64 years. I give all of the credit for everything to her. She's been gone for 9 years, and I cannot tell you how much I miss her every day. Unquote. And again, that baseball features entitled Oldest Living Met Looks Back at 70 Years in Baseball, written by Bob Nightingale of USA Today. And now let's look at some short news from around the baseball world. The St. Louis Cardinals were hoping that hanging on to closer Ryan Helsley the first half of the season would enhance his trade value. But after saving a league-leading 49 games last year, he has only 5 saves in 7 opportunities with a 3.75 ERA. Meanwhile, they're still trying to trade All-Star third baseman Nolan Arenado. The Los Angeles Dodgers have yet to express interest while still hoping that third baseman Max Muncy escapes his early season struggles. And if the Baltimore Orioles are not a contender by the All-Star break, teams will be pouncing on starter Zach Eflin, reliever Sir Anthony Dominguez, and center fielder Cedric Mullins at the trade deadline. And it turns out that the teams that waited out the free agent market wound up getting the best bargains in baseball. For example, starting pitcher Jose Quintana, Milwaukee Brewers, 1 year, $4.25 million contract in March. He is 4 wins, 1 loss, Quintana is, with a 2.83 ERA. Another starter, Nick Pivetta of the San Diego Padres, has a 4-year contract for $55 million, written in February. His record, 5-1, with a 1.78 ERA. Then there's infielder Jorge Polanco of the Seattle Mariners, who has a 1-year, $7 million contract signed in February. He's hitting .380 with 9 homers and 26 RBIs. Then there's first baseman Pete Alonso of the New York Mets with a 2-year, $54 million contract signed in February. His batting average, Pete Alonso's, is .347 with 8 homers and 30 RBIs. Next is third baseman Alex Bregman of the Boston Red Sox, who signed a 3-year contract for $120 million in February. His record so far this year, batting average of .317 with 8 homers and 27 RBIs. Then there's reliever Shelby Miller of the Arizona Diamondbacks, who signed a 1-year, $1 million contract in February. Shelby Miller's record, 3 wins, no losses, with a 1.23 ERA in 14 appearances. And remember when everyone thought that the Los Angeles Dodgers had too much pitching? Well, they made history this past week when they became the first team in history to use 11 different starting pitchers before May, thanks to 13 pitchers on the injured list. No pitching staff has produced fewer innings by its starters, and no bullpen has thrown more innings. It is not a good quality of life, Dodgers pitching coach Mark Pryor told reporters. And future Hall of Famer Justin Verlander badly wants to join the exclusive 300-win club, but time is running out. He is stuck at 262 victories with the Giants, blowing his last three games in which he has yielded a 1.96 ERA. And who would have imagined that the small trade in December when the Yankees acquired right-handed reliever Fernando Cruz and minor league catcher Alex Johnson from the Cincinnati Reds for catcher Jose Trevino would pay such dividends? Cruz has been one of the game's most stunning surprises, striking out 28 batters, second most by any reliever in baseball, in just 18 and two-thirds innings with a 1.62 ERA. And Trevino filled in quite nicely during Tyler Stevenson's absence, hitting .319 with an .887 OPS. And do you wonder how important three-time batting champion Luis Arraez is to the San Diego Padres lineup? As of press time, the Padres were 19 wins, 6 losses with him in the starting lineup, and 1 win, 5 losses without him. The Padres are about to become even better with center field sensation Jackson Merrill expected to return later this week. And the most underrated player in baseball continues to be Cleveland Guardians third baseman Jose Ramirez, who became the first third baseman in history to hit at least 250 homers and steal 250 bases in his career. And Chicago White Sox center fielder Luis Robert finally started to hit this past week. If it continues, the White Sox hope to have him traded by Memorial Day. And the Kansas City Royals are trying to become the first team since the year 1900 to reach the postseason, averaging less than 3.5 runs per game in a season. They have hit just 15 homers all season, but yet still have a winning record in the woeful American League Central Division. And kudos to Baltimore Orioles general manager Mike Elias for blaming himself and no one else for their woeful starting rotation, which is yielding the worst ERA in the American League. The Orioles failed to re-sign free agent Corbin Burnes and then tried to replace him with Charlie Morton, age 41, Kyle Gibson, age 37, and Tomoyuki Sugano, age 35. I'm in charge of baseball operations, Elias told reporters, and when we have a bad record to start the year, that is my responsibility, unquote. And it's painful for the pocketbook, but the Cincinnati Reds have officially benched third baseman Heimer Candelario, who's batting .113 with a .410 OPS, who signed a 3-year, $45 million contract a year ago. And in other baseball short news, Zach Gallen, who will be a coveted free agent this winter, certainly loves pitching in New York. He's 2 wins, no losses, with a .071 ERA and 21 strikeouts in 2 starts this season at Citi Field and Yankee Stadium, compared to no wins, 4 losses, and a .701 ERA everywhere else. And no one delivers heartbreak like the Cleveland Guardians, who now have 12 walk-off victories against the Minnesota Twins since just the year 2022. And how impressive has the Cubs' offense been this season? The Cubs have scored at least 10 runs in 8 games this season. And welcome back, Lance McCullers Jr., who started on May the 4th for the Houston Astros in his first game since the 2022 World Series, spanning 915 days. And in one more short baseball feature, this headline reads, Major League Baseball's Manfred considering an end to the Pete Rose ban. Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred confirmed that he will make a ruling about the continuation of Pete Rose's ban from baseball not long after he met with President Donald Trump to discuss the topic. Manfred spoke on April the 28th at a meeting of the Associated Press sports editors, where he confirmed that he spoke with Trump at the White House. The meeting, originally reported by the Washington Post, took place on April the 16th. Quote, I met with President Trump 2 weeks ago, and one of the topics was Pete Rose, but I'm not going beyond that, Manfred said. He said what he said publicly, unquote. Trump took a stance on the matter of Rose's ban when he announced on his social media platform, Truth Social, on February 28th that he, quote, will be signing a complete pardon of Pete Rose, unquote. The president said that Rose shouldn't have been gambling on baseball, but only bet on his team winning, unquote. He has yet to follow through on a pardon, and it is unclear if it would cover the player's legal issues. Rose served 5 months of prison time for tax evasion in 1990. Baseball's all-time hit leader with 4,256 hits, Rose died on September 30th, 2024, at age 83. His death reignited calls for him to be reinstated by the league so that he might someday be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Jeffrey Lenkoff, a lawyer who represented Rose, filed a petition to Major League Baseball in January that aimed for Rose to be posthumously removed from the ineligible list. Manfred didn't offer a timeline for his decision. Quote, I'm not going to give this the pocket veto, Manfred said. I will, in fact, issue a ruling, unquote. Should Rose be reinstated, he would need to be nominated by the Hall of Fame's Historical Overview Committee to be eligible to appear on the Classic Baseball Era ballot. Manfred also said that he is concerned with Trump's immigration policies affecting Major League Baseball's scores of foreign-born players from countries such as Cuba, Venezuela, and the Dominican Republic. Quote, given the number of foreign-born players we have, we are always concerned about ingress and egress, Manfred said. We have had dialogue with the administration about this topic. And, you know, they are very interested in sports. They understand the unique need to be able to go back and forth, and I'm going to leave it at that, unquote. And again, that short feature entitled Major League Baseball's Manfred Considering an End to the Pete Rose Ban. And from baseball news, let's turn now to some NBA playoff news. The next headline reads, Steph Curry out with hamstring strain. And this feature written by Kevin Pelton of ESPN News. The Golden State Warriors won Game 1 of their second-round series with the Minnesota Timberwolves on Tuesday, claiming home court advantage as the lower seed, but it came at a high cost. After leaving the game with a hamstring injury, star guard Steph Curry was diagnosed Wednesday with a grade 1 strain, as reported by ESPN's Shane Charmia. With the Warriors expected to play at least the next week without Curry, which would mean missing the next three games at a minimum, they'll have to find a way to continue Tuesday's shooting-driven success without Curry. Let's break down how Golden State will handle Curry's absence in Game 2 and how quickly the Warriors might need him to return to reach the conference finals for the first time since winning the 2022 championship with Curry as the finals MVP. Up 10 points when Curry hobbled off not long after he made a three-pointer to give him 13 points in as many minutes on the court, Golden State actually extended the lead to as many as 23 points before holding off a fourth-quarter run by Minnesota. Without the greatest shooter in NBA history, the Warriors still went 5 out of 9 from three-point land in the pivotal third quarter when Buddy Hield made 3 to continue his hot streak dating back to Sunday's Game 7 win over the Houston Rockets. Draymond Green also did a fair Curry impression, making 4 three-pointers, his most in a playoff game since the 2017 season, with 2 of them coming just after Curry left the court. Meanwhile, the Timberwolves' inaccurate shooting carried over from where they finished a 5-game series win over the Los Angeles Lakers, despite going 4 out of 47 from 3-point range in Game 5. Minnesota missed all 15 tries from beyond the arc in the first half, and 16 in a row before Naz Reid finally broke the drought early in the third quarter. The Timberwolves finished 5 out of 29, which is 17% on three-pointers, their second-worst percentage in a game all season. That won't carry over to Game 2. In fact, you might be surprised by how little Game 1 shooting percentages from three-point range tell us about what to expect going forward. Over the past decade, there's been no relationship between three-point percentages in the first two games of a series. Scoring without Curry has been a problem for Golden State dating back to the team's 5 consecutive finals appearances and 3 titles from 2015 through 2019. Over the course of the regular season, Warriors lineups without Curry ranked in the 11th percentile league-wide in offensive rating, according to Gleaning the Glass. However, the addition of Jimmy Butler at the trade deadline gives Golden State a fighting chance to cobble together a competitive offense. Not only is Butler a better playmaker than any other Warriors option at point guard, his ability to get to the free throw line backstops Golden State's efficiency. Lineups with Butler but not Curry scored at a league average rate after the deadline, according to Gleaning the Glass, and outscored opponents by an impressive 12.8 points per 100 possessions thanks to their defense. The biggest challenge for Warriors coach Steve Kerr over the next handful of games might be avoiding running Butler into the ground. After all, he's also dealing with an injury, having missed Game 3 against Houston in the first round due to a pelvis contusion. Since returning, Butler has averaged 20 points a game, but is shooting just 42% from the field. Kerr and the Golden State coaching staff will have to carefully manage when to rest Butler, leaving them without a lead playmaker. The Warriors staggered his minutes with Green in the second half, sitting Butler for the final 3-plus minutes of the third quarter. With regular season stalwarts Moses Moody and Quinton Post struggling, Curry's absence also forced Steve Kerr deeper into his rotation on Tuesday. Jonathan Kuminga played 13 minutes, contributing 5 points, and Pat Spencer was an unlikely source of energy with 4 points and two steals after playing only the final 8 seconds of Game 7 against the Rockets. Ordinarily, the Warriors taking Game 1 of what looked like a toss-up series on the road would give them the clear edge. Instead, due to Curry's injury, Minnesota is now bigger favorites at ESPN Bet than before the series. Combine Curry's absence with the tendency for teams that lose Game 1 at home to bounce back in Game 2, and Minnesota is favored by 10.5 points on Thursday. I'd expect them to be favorites for Games 3 and 4 in the Bay Area as well, albeit more narrowly. Beyond the time that Curry will miss, the other issue for the Warriors is how well that he performs upon returning. If Curry rushes back, his mobility will likely be compromised to some degree. Re-injury is also a concern with a hamstring strain. Any additional wins that Golden State can pick up between now and when he is cleared will make it easier to get him as close to 100% as possible when he does return. Either way, Curry's injury cast the Warriors' improbable Game 1 victory in a much different light. And again, that feature is entitled Steph Curry Out with Hamstring Strain, written by Kevin Pelton of ESPN. That's all the time that we have for this edition of Sports Today. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Have a great evening. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.